Welcome to the Horses and Life Podcast, Episode 4. I just spent a week in Pennsylvania, and the weather was perfect. The last couple of days I was there, it got above freezing, so that was nice. Got to do a little bit of riding outside and see the ranch for those of the people that haven't been able to see it much yet, and then we checked the cows, and we had a good clinic before I left. Yeah, some new people show up to the clinic, and it's always enjoyable for me to meet some new people and help them get these things working within themselves and within their horses. The horses that are owned by Dublin Gap Ranch, of course, I spent a lot of time riding those while I was there, and we had a lot of progress there, and it's sure good to see the improvement each time I go. And the people that work there are getting better and getting their horses well taken care of in the winter, and everything's progressing, so it's good to see. I'm back here in Texas now. It's about 70 degrees, and it's a nice day here at the McCall Ranch right on the Colorado River. Decided to add one more clinic before I leave Texas, so this weekend, this Saturday, February 2nd, I'll have a clinic here at McCall Ranch in Bastrop, Texas. So there'll be some more information about that on my Facebook page and a few other places. You can always email us or contact me in some way to find out some more information if you can't find it or if you don't get what you need there. And then after the clinic, I'll be packing up and heading east. I will be heading to North Carolina. I'll be in Morganton, North Carolina for a clinic February 9th and 10th. And I'll be in that area for a little bit, and then I'll head up to Pennsylvania at the end of February. I'll be at the Horse World Expo in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, doing some demonstrations February 28th through March 3rd. That's a four-day expo, and thousands of people there, lots of booths, lots of entertainment, a little bit of education, and I hope you guys can come join me if you're in that area. And then we'll have a four-day clinic at Dublin Gap Ranch in Newville, Pennsylvania, and that'll be March 23rd through 26th. So, other than that, I don't have really anything new to tell you about or to announce. I continue to appreciate those of you that have supported the podcast, and I will ask you to continue to do so. Keep sharing it out there as much as you can and keep telling people about it. And hopefully other people will enjoy it. Today you'll be listening to the third of four interviews from my trip to Costa Rica a few weeks ago. Today will be Johan, and Johan is a biologist. He's a bee expert, and bees is something that I've always been a little interested in. I remember when I was young, there was a man not too far from where I grew up that had some horses, and I went there, and he had some bees, and we went there to kind of check out the bees, and he had a suit on and moving the hive around and getting some of the honey out, and that was pretty impressive to me how that worked. Later, my grandfather and I had some bees together that we took care of, and I enjoyed that time for sure. And besides the fact that the bees are super interesting, the way that they add to our ecosystem and the way that they change what's happening around us once you truly understand what they're doing all the time and what their purpose is. But I always have enjoyed the taste of honey. And like my grandfather, I put honey on about everything I can. So, without further ado, I hope you enjoy the conversation. I bring you Johan van Veen. Okay, I'm here at the National University of Costa Rica with my friend Johan. And we're going to talk a little bit about some bees today. So, Johan, thank you for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And, well, let's have a conversation about bees, stingless bees, which are tropical bees. And then we work with Africanized bees and European honeybees.
So we just took a quick tour. Sometimes I'm talking to the listeners and sometimes I'm talking to you, of course. But we just took a quick tour and we looked around and he showed me some of the stingless bees that they have right here at the university. Really interesting, something I didn't know a lot about. Tell us a little bit of the history of those stingless bees that you were telling me about.
Stingless bees are native to the tropical parts of the world, but especially in the neotropics, they are very abundant. There are more than 400 species known. And in Costa Rica, we have 59, as far as we know yet. And the Mayas, especially in the Yucatan Peninsula, but also in the dry parts of Central America, they would have these bees, they would raise these bees, and they would have their god. So they would have their ceremony then. And I'm talking about 1,500, 2,000 years ago that we already know that they were having these bees, raising these bees. So it's interesting because then when the Spaniards came, it was so abundant that all families would have these bees in their house. These bees are kept in logs and people would produce honey with them. So then when the Spaniards converted, for instance, the people to the Catholic religion, they would mark the hives with a cross to indicate which people already were converted. And
because every family had a hive of bees.
Yeah, it was very, very common. And people would use it as a sweetener, but also as a medicine. And then they made a drink, alcoholic beverage, which is called balche, which is a kind of mead. And they used that as a medicine as well, but also to offer the gods and ask then for a good harvest. So these are interesting details in the culture. Yeah.
A lot of history there.
Yeah. And the Indians would have to pay tax to the Spaniards in botijas, which is like a clay pot filled with honey. And then there's also the famous wax from Campeche, which actually is a wax from stingless bees. And the Spaniards would be very interested in this wax because they considered that the bees were virgin. So only wax then produced by virgin bees would be suitable to make candles for the church.
Wow, isn't that something?
Yeah, it's nice.
It's kind of silly looking back on some of it. Today, we look back on some of those things and we think that's silly, but it was an important thing. It was a big deal.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
So the Africanized bees are a little ways further away. You said you had to move those away from the university once they got more public here.
The African bees, they're well known also as the killer bees because of their defensive behavior. I rather speak of defensive than aggressive because bees will not attack people just for fun. I mean, they'll defend their hives, but then they can sting a lot. So you can't keep them close to the houses. So we can't have them in the garden of our research institute either. We had to remove them so to avoid accidents.
So here at the research center, tell our listeners what it is that you're doing here. What's the purpose of you doing the research on the bees, whether the stingless bees or the Africanized bees?
Yeah, well, we do both because we try to get the stingless bees are native bees. So we try people to become interested in raising them again in order to protect them for conservation. Because they play a very important role in the pollination of the native flora. So they're important for a lot of native plants, wild plants, but also crops. Some tropical crops, like, for instance, chayote, which is commonly grown throughout Costa Rica, that's pollinated exclusively by stingless bees. So they are important for that reason. But then beekeepers, when in the 80s, the Africanized bees came from the south and they crossed the Panama Canal, I think that was in 82. Then in 84, they came to Costa Rica. And then the beekeepers who would have European bees, and they would have them close to their house. They would have them together with the cows and the horses and their dogs and cats. And in the patio near their house, in the garden of the house, in the backyard, they couldn't have them anymore because of this defensive behavior. So many of them said, well, no more bees for me. I mean, these are simply too aggressive. So then we obtained a loan from the Inter-American Development Bank, and we used that for building a research institute, trying to support beekeepers and offering them the tools to start managing Africanized bees, because you can perfectly well produce honey with these bees. Well, you have to manage them then in a different way than the traditional management of your European honeybees. So that's basically what we do here.
When I was younger, I remember hearing stories about the killer bees coming from South America, and they're coming this way, and they're going to take over the United States. And obviously, there were some extreme thoughts there. But was that an extreme, ridiculous fear, or was there some real fear at that time that was happening, or real danger?
The history of the Africanized bees goes back to the 50s to Brazil, where there was a professor who thought that if I want to develop beekeeping in, especially in the humid areas of the tropics, like the Amazon, for instance, I will have to crossbreed the European bees with some tropical bee. So they become more adapted and produce honey better, are less susceptible maybe to diseases and plagues. So that's what he did. And so he had seen actually very productive bees in Africa. So he imported queens of these bees to Brazil and started crossbreeding. Some of these swarms apparently escaped. I mean, it's not really well documented what happened. And these established in the wild. And these bees started migrating. African bees can migrate very well because of the conditions in Africa where you have long dry periods and that there's no flowering at all. So these bees reproduce and then abscond, so they can really fly kilometers and kilometers looking for new floral resources. So that's their natural biology. And then it is thought that the people in Africa are not really beekeepers. They're more like bee hunters. So they would leave the most defensive bees alone. So they think that during thousands of years, there's been a pressure from humankind then towards this behavior, this trait of defensiveness in these bees. So these defensive bees then came to Brazil. They escaped. They started spreading throughout the tropics. And in every country where they arrived, and it was well documented, oh, very aggressive bees, they will sting. And then obviously there were accidents, people killed also by these bees. So yeah, then you create a fear amongst the people. So then they try to stop them. They try to spray forests, trying to kill them. But I mean, these bees are very well adapted. So they spread. And right now, obviously, they are in the United States. I mean, they're all the way from Florida to California in the southern states, Texas, everywhere. Well, beekeepers, what they typically do is then they control the queen in the hive, since the queen is the mother of all bees. If you have a European queen introduced into an Africanized beehive, then gradually, after, let's say, 6-7 weeks, all the worker bees then are from the new queen. So these are tame bees and you can manage them well. So that's typically what beekeepers do.
There's a lot of things there. So we call these bees, back to the stingless bees for a minute, we call them native to this area, but obviously that's the correct term. But the Mayans were actually breeding these bees and they were genetically engineering these bees back then as far as just selectively breeding.
Yeah, but that's the stingless bees then. Yeah, that's correct. The typical thing of bees is that during the nuptial flight, the queen gets fertilized for the rest of her life. What's happening then is that you cannot control the wild population. And that's where the drones come from. So that means that although you breed bees, you do not have a control about this aspect in the reproductive biology. So it's not really a domesticated animal. It's like half wild anyway. And that's what happened then. I mean, the European bees, when they were introduced in different parts of America, that's for instance here in Costa Rica, that was at the end of the 19th century, there was no wild population of honeybees. So then you really control by bringing in the bees you select, and that's what you breed with. So that's really like kind of a selection you can have. And now that we have a wild population of Africanized bees, the problem is that beekeepers who start raising bees with European bees, as soon as a new queen has to reproduce and has to get fertilized, then that happens with the drones from the wild population. That's why where the word Africanized comes from. So, I mean, these are European bees, crossbred then with the wild population of African bees, forming a hybrid bee, which is an Africanized bee. And after 3 generations, you actually have an African bee again.
Wow, that's really interesting. So how is the program working as far as trying to get more local people raising bees again? What's the impact? What's it been? Are people pretty receptive? Are people not so receptive to sometimes? Or?
Costa Rica has a good honey consumption. So a per capita of about 300, 350 grams, which is more than average. And it's also paid well. So honey prices are quite high. So for the economic part, there's an interest then of raising bees and producing honey. And on the other hand, well, if you offer people like nowadays, I mean, they can get a good bee suit, a good veil, good gloves. And we teach them then how to manage these hives that the bees produce. They do not invest all the resources they collect into reproduction, like producing colonies and new swarms, but directing this effort also to honey production. And then you have quite a resistant bee, resistant to bee diseases, and producing honey well. But it's basically management techniques. And some are small, apparently small differences, but for the bees, they make a great difference. And also then for the beekeeper. So, I mean, you can control the defensiveness quite well. You can select in favor of less defensive hives within this population of African bees. And that works well.
It's the little small things that kind of make up the big picture, seems yes. to be. It's the same in what I do.
Like smoking appropriately a hive, which sounds very obvious to many beekeepers, but many people do not know how to apply smoke well, effectively.
When I was younger, my grandfather had a few beehives, and I enjoyed a little bit of that with him. Right before he passed away, we got to do some of that. I've always loved honey. My grandpa put honey on everything. He put honey on pizza. He used to say, well, you have to do something to improve the taste of that stuff, you know, because he was always more into home-cooked meals, you know, and somebody'd bring home some pizza sometimes, and he'd say, okay, let's get some honey out and put on there or something. But anyway, I put honey on about everything I can, and always enjoyed that. So tell us a little bit about some of the books. I took a picture, and it'll be on my website. It's calmiddleton.com/podcast for those of you that haven't seen it. But it'll be about this episode. There'll be some pictures of some of the bees today and some of the books. But is there a book or two there that you would recommend for somebody starting out that's wanting to just get some bees going?
Yes, I think that as a beekeeper, you have to decide the kind of management you want to give to your hive. Is that like what you could kind of call traditional beekeeping? Which means that you buy, for instance, chemicals that you apply to your bees to control certain plagues or diseases? Or do you want to go for a more natural way of beekeeping, which I would recommend because I don't think chemicals and bees go well together. And I rather don't have any of these chemicals in my honey either. So I don't want to contaminate my hive or the wax in it or the honey in it with some product. So if you would go for the natural way of beekeeping, then there's Michael Bush, who has a very nice book, I would say, about that for beekeepers of different levels, either starters or more experienced beekeepers. Anybody can find something in there. And then there's also, I think it's Conrad, who has a book on organic beekeeping as well. So I can recommend both of them. They give a good introduction. They're quite nice for starters. And then, yeah, then there's the more traditional beekeeping books also, yeah. Start with a few hives. I would say keep them away from crops because crops are usually sprayed heavily with all kinds of chemicals, whether herbicides or fungicides or insecticides. It doesn't really matter that much. Glyphosate, everything, I mean, it will finally get to harm your bees.
So how far will a bee travel? Like when you say keep them away from crops, I mean, how far away?
Like a mile and a half easily. Yeah, on average, that's what they will travel. So just some natural environment where you think that not many heavily sprayed crops are that can be visited by the bees. That's what I would recommend, yeah. And there are several associations in the United States for organic beekeeping, for instance. If you apply a management to the bees, which is based actually on their biology, then you can perfectly raise healthy, resistant bees that maybe if they would need any help, you can apply some kind of essential oils, for instance. But basically, it's a management based on the biology of bees will give a good result.
Sure, sure. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you feed with sugar, you can understand that sugar for a bee is not the same thing as honey. Right. So feed bees, at least if you have to give them some sugar syrup, then add some honey to it that will help correct for the pH, the sourness of the honey, which is better for the bees. And well, it also has more minerals. It has some vitamins in it that will all help bees to stay healthy.
Really cool. So how many species of bees do you manage here at the university?
We manage a few species. We work apart from the honeybees then with several species of stingless bees. Stingless bees can produce honey. It's in small quantities, but it's a very medicinal honey. So it has high antibacterial activity, antiviral activity, often 10 times higher than honeybee honey. So there's a growing interest then for that application amongst local people, but also internationally. So even though the quantities of honeys can be small, from one jar to maybe like a gallon in the larger species, the price for this honey is quite high, easily up to $50 a bottle, can be obtained. So that's quite nice. So we work with some of these species also and try people to know how to reproduce them, how to box them in specifically designed hive boxes for these species. And well, basically that's what we teach to the local communities, also with the perspective then of conservation. I mean, Costa Rica is still quite proud on its nature and it has a very diverse nature. And it's known that thousands of blooming plants require some bee for pollination. And pollination is the process which originates the seeds for the plants. So it's the reproduction of the plant. So without these bees, you don't have these plants either. For instance, in Costa Rica, as an example, there's a family of orchid bees. And the males of these orchid bees often collect some essential oil on the flower of the orchid. He makes himself more attractive by collecting, because of the smell of these essential oils, to the female. So with that, he has a reproductive success. So that's his benefit. And then the orchid gets pollinated by these bees. These are very specific relationships. So as long as these bees exist, they can pollinate the orchids. Once these bees disappear, the orchid loses its pollinator and will also extinguish. So, I mean, it's really, we become extinct. So, I mean, that's really something that there are so many of these relationships in nature, which people do not always realize. So it's very important to save the bees.
Sure, of course, of course. Okay, let's change gears just for a minute. You have a PhD in biology. From where?
That's from Utrecht University in the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands, which is where you're from.
Yes. And I started here in 1990.
Came to Costa Rica in 1990.
Yeah. And that was actually for studying the biologically limiting factors of the raising of stingless bees. Yeah. So that was a research project for 3 years. And during these 3 years was when we obtained the loan from the Inter-American Development Bank, which made it possible then to construct our research facilities. And today we are like here with 8 scientists and we have a few beekeepers working for us. So we have a master's course on beekeeping. Basically students from Central America and some from South America as well. So that's a year and a half program. So we do that. And then we have a very strong task. We visit lots of beekeepers associations, and we provide trainings on all kinds of topics. For instance, the small hive beetle has just come to Costa Rica. So that's a new plague. So we prepare beekeepers for that. And now that the small hive beetle is here, we try to help them also in either preventing damage from these beetles to the hives or...
And that's a beetle that does what?
It arrived from South Africa like something like 15 or 20 years ago or so. It came to Florida. So it was first to Florida, but since U.S. beekeepers migrate with their hives for crop pollination throughout the states, it became spread quite fast. So then it came to the north of Mexico, and then from Mexico, we think it went to Guatemala, and it's now also in El Salvador. We know it's in Nicaragua. So it's going further and further south. It's not specific an animal that affects bees. It can also reproduce, for instance, consuming fruits. So it's an opportunistic beetle.
Tell me a little bit about the future here as far as what's going to be happening next. Is it just keep trying to continue to get out into the public, keep trying to teach people about bees here? Do we have any new plans on the horizon?
Well, since the environment is constantly changing, this means that there's always something happening. I mean, in 2012, for instance, I started doing research on how the climate change, also in Costa Rica, is affected by the climate change, obviously. And how does that affect and impact on beekeeping and honey production, and what measures can beekeepers finally take, for instance, to reduce the effect of climate change? I mean, what strategies can they apply to keep producing honey? For instance, this year we have a very dry year. That's then because of the effect of El Nino, which causes more drought in the area of, yeah, where beekeeping is basically done in Costa Rica, which is in the drier parts, like in Guanacaste and Punta Arenas provinces. Yeah, what our research indicates is that in the dry years, all plants bloom earlier. So that means if you have beekeepers who prepare their hives well for these early bloomings, they can still produce honey in quite significant quantities. Those beekeepers who wait too long in preparing their hives, they end up preparing the hives still with these bloomings. And once they have their hives well developed and could start producing honey, then because of the drought and whatever flowering there is, it's really dry. There's little nectar in the flower, so the bees can't really produce honey very well.
When did you get interested in bees? When you were
well, young, actually, also with my grandfather, I think. Yeah. Well, as a kid at school, I was already interested in insects. So I would have a small insect collection, collect some of the butterflies. And I was always very interested in ants, actually. I don't know why, but I mean, somehow, I thought it's interesting. So I knew already at school that I wanted to study biology. So when I studied biology, I came at a department for social insects, for the study of social insects, where they would work basically on honeybees, but they also had a small line then on ants. So I did a topic on reproduction in ants, in an ant species in the Netherlands. And that worked out well. And well, I don't know, obviously you learn about beekeeping there as well. So I thought, well, so when they started then the project in Costa Rica, I said, well, that's interesting. I'd very much like to do it. It's only for 3 years, not?
Right.
Which is now 29 years ago.
29 years. So you've been here for a while. Of course, I met you through your wife, Margot, who I know from the horse treks over there. Are you a horse rider also?
No, not really, no. Not really.
You've ridden a few times.
Oh, yes, I did. And I enjoy it a lot, yeah, yes.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. You have two boys. One's over in New Zealand.
Yeah, he just left for New Zealand, yes.
And then one's here at the university.
Yeah.
Yeah, so did the boys grow up here for the most part, of course?
Yeah, they were born here and they grew up.
But they don't look like the typical Costa Rican.
No, not really. I mean, both parents are Dutch. I mean.
It's funny. Sometimes Margot and I have been places. We go here, we go there, and I have my cowboy hat on and I don't shave when I'm down here usually, and I'm darker complected, and people walk up and start speaking Spanish to me, and I kind of point to her, and then she starts speaking Spanish to them. She's blonde, you know, and it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking to the wrong person.
Yeah.
But no, that's great. So if somebody wants to learn most of the in-person stuff here, do you have some things online available that you guys teach about, or is it something that people need to come see you for?
Yeah, they best come and see us. We don't have much online yet. That's actually something that we are working on. I mean, we are changing because we do, well, I mean, I guess we are all like in the 50s, like I am. So, I mean, kind of traditional way of teaching, and I don't think that we do explore the possibilities of internet, virtual courses, for instance, enough. So we are changing. We are working on that.
It's obviously important today. You know, we have to get out there. I mean, here I am making a podcast. I mean, we're trying to do things through the internet. But I know that through my work, there's nothing that can ever replace that actual in-face, human-to-human interactive learning. There's nothing that can really replace that. I know there's information that you can put out there, people can read online or they can watch a video about it. But as far as the actual teaching process, that has to be more difficult.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's the same thing with beekeeping. You can learn a lot from the books, but putting on this coverall and then light up your smoker and go and visit a hive and really know then or connect somehow your theoretical knowledge from the books with what you see in the hive, that's different. It requires being a good observer and also, yeah, some experience, obviously. Yeah.
So Costa Rica, in this area, we're close to San Jose here, and this area has changed a lot since you started the research.
Oh, yes.
Here.
We used to be, like, the Central Valley has very fertile soils. So there used to be a lot of coffee plantations, and there's still some left. It's still a significant area, but for instance, when we lived near the center of this provincial town of Heredia, which is where the university is, we would be surrounded by coffee fields, coffee plantations. And nowadays, I mean, you have to travel at least a kilometer to see these coffee plantations. So that means it's all become constructed. I mean, there's so many housing projects going on.
That's a kilometer in the city, which takes a while to get there.
Yeah.
It's not a kilometer in Guanacaste or in
that's correct.
Central Missouri. Yeah. Okay. So I'll give you one final thought here that you can kind of finish up with us. Whether you're talking to some young people who are interested in bees or just some young people who are starting off on life and they're interested in starting out, what's some things that you'd want them to know about going on? You've lived some life.
Well, I would say that it's very interesting for young people also to start with beekeeping. It's a very good way to connect with nature. It's a very good way to get out of your office, get out of town, get out of your car, get out of your house, just connect with nature for a while, admire the bees. It can finally, if it's really something that would suit you, it can become quite a nice activity to do in your spare time. The thing with bees is like, I mean, a cow, you will have to milk your cow every morning, whether it's Christmas or not, and in the afternoon again. I mean, with bees, if you just have a weekend, you say, well, not this weekend, fine, it's fine with the bees. I mean, they can handle themselves. So, I mean, it's very flexible activity. It doesn't require much of an investment either. And it can be very rewarding. I mean, it's really beautiful to see how bees build their comb, how they seemingly work all together in a hive and defend it, build it. It's really very nice. Yeah.
It would kind of be nice, I think, a lot of times if more people could learn to get along like that, work together, do things, create things like that.
Yeah. And yeah, I think also if you start admiring the bees, if you start realizing how important they are in the planet, really taking care of the reproduction of the plants, reproducing of the crops. So, I mean, people become more actively aware then of the importance of nature and not like see it as a kind of zoological. I mean, we are part of nature, I think, and it's a healthy way of living, as it would be, I think, also if you start with horses, if bees is nothing for you. I mean, it's a good way to connect with animals, nature, and relax for a while. It's a good stress-reducing activity.
Yeah, if it's not bees, if it's not horses, and find something.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Sure. Welcome.
If you're enjoying the Horses and Life podcast, there are many ways you can support it. You can obviously tell people about it. You can tell your friends about it. You can share it through social media or any other means. You can go to patreon.com and support it financially. There's a little more information on my website about the podcast. Also on my website, calmiddleton.com, please be sure you sign up for my monthly newsletters through my email subscription list. Until next time, enjoy each day.